Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, a two-parter. In our first segment, we talk with Harvard University professor Serhiy Plohy. His new book takes us back to 1944 in Ukraine, when American flyers were permitted to use Soviet air bases to attack the Nazis from their Eastern Front. And in part two, we talk with photojournalist and photo editor Richard Cahan. Together with Mark Jacob and Michael Williams, they've published a powerful book of photographs called Aftershock, The Human Toll of War. I think you'll find this a fascinating look back at World War II. And we also get Professor Plohy's comments on Ukraine's central role in the unfolding impeachment investigation of Donald J. Trump. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions. People like David Radcliffe, Gunnar Gunderson, and Stuart Russell. They each kick in $10 a month. Can you chip in $5, $10, maybe $20? I'd appreciate it. Take that thought to peterbcollins.com. Click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber, and you'll land on the sign-up page. Thanks for listening, and send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we take you back to 1944, 1945, a critical juncture in World War II, when American airmen fought behind the lines of the Soviet Union.
Falling back before the gates of Moscow, standing in the wings like an avenger. And far away behind their lines, the partisans are stirring in the forest. Coming unexpectedly upon their outposts, growing like a promise. You'll never know, you'll never know which way to turn, which way to look, you'll never see us.
Al Stewart opens the podcast today, a powerful tune from back in the 1970s called Roads to Moscow. And returning to our podcast today is Professor Serhiy Plohy, who teaches history and Ukrainian history at Harvard University. He was with us a year and a half ago when we talked about his powerful book, Chernobyl. And that was subsequently awarded the 2018 Bailey Gifford Prize. Professor, welcome back to our program today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back.
And I want to tell you that I'm still recommending your Chernobyl book to friends and interested people. There was interest sparked by, I think it was a Netflix or maybe an HBO series in the past year. But you did a magnificent job not only of explaining the sequence of events of the accident at Chernobyl and how it was discovered, but the big takeaway from that book was how Chernobyl really led to, in many ways, the disintegration of the Soviet Union, because it forced full disclosure, or at least some disclosure and transparency. And that glasnost was a critical element in the major shifts in the early 1990s.
Well, absolutely. First of all, thank you for recommending my book. And second, thanks for such a wonderful summary, because that is exactly what is one of the contributions of the book. I show how the mobilization of the people in the Soviet Union, particularly in Ukraine, around the issues of ecology and the threat posed by the nuclear fallout, how that led to the start of political life, organized political life in the Soviet Union, and eventually contributed to the fall of the superpower. So those things, Chernobyl and the end of the USSR, are really, really closely connected.
And Professor Plohy has a brand new book out called Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But as the director of the Ukrainian Research Institute there at Harvard, Professor, I cannot resist asking you to comment on the current role that Ukraine is playing in the impeachment investigation conducted by the House of Representatives. Tell me just broadly what you think about this.
Well, very broadly, I don't know what to think, because never I expected that Ukraine would be at the very center of American politics. And the big question is why, and there are some immediate answers, and they're certainly given by media today, but there are also deeper historical reasons for that. And one of them is that Ukraine is extremely important for post-Cold War world, and that's the place where the Cold War really never ended. There was never really an agreement between the United States and Russia on what will happen with the post-Soviet space, how independent countries of Ukraine can be in terms of its choice of the political system, in terms of its of their political alliances. And really, we are dealing today with some kind of a postponed thing from the early 1990s. Again, the so-called Budapest Memorandum was signed by President Clinton in 1994, which transferred nuclear arsenal from Ukraine to Russia. And it was believed that the problem disappeared, but it didn't. So,
and Professor, may I interject, because I have a question about that I wanted to ask you. I recall that the agreement was that in exchange for giving up nuclear weapons, which had been deposited in Ukraine when it was part of the Soviet Union, that the United States guaranteed the security of Ukraine. And isn't it correct that President Obama failed to honor that agreement in 2013, 2014?
The guarantee is that's what the Ukrainian diplomats wanted, and that's what they didn't get. What they got in return were the assurances. And again, before I started to read on that subject, I didn't realize what was the difference between guarantees and assurances. And guarantees meant that if the Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity were violated, then the signatories would act immediately to restore and bring back the status quo or the situation that was before. And assurances meant that they could do that if they wished. And the irony was that not only the United States, but also Russia was one of the four signatories of the agreements, and they violated it, and indeed the response from the United States on President Obama's watch was I would say, measured. There can be, of course, different words used, but again, it was measured, and the assistance, military assistance, the so-called little weapons were never supplied.
And Professor, this parsing of guarantees versus assurances, in your view, was that deceptive on the part of the United States, either at the time that Bill Clinton agreed to them or at the time that Barack Obama ignored them?
It was a clear position on the part of the United States that they were not prepared to give guarantees. So the Ukrainians were informed about that and knew that. And from the now new archival evidence, we know that some of the Ukrainian diplomats were saying, okay, we understand that that really doesn't give us much, but at least we'll have a piece of paper once that happens that we can refer to. So that was a position that the United States was not prepared to go further. And one of the reasons for that was that no one could really imagine, apart from the Ukrainians, that Russia would eventually try to take part of Ukraine's territory, like it is the case with the Crimea. The general idea and understanding was that we reached the end of history, that the liberalism won, the international conflicts, to a degree that they existed, they would be solved through the United Nations or peaceful negotiations, that we were moving into the 21st century, which would be different from the 20th. So there was this general euphoria after the end of the Cold War, and I don't believe also that the American diplomats at that time or presidents like Clinton imagined what would come next.
And, Professor, didn't that agreement also stipulate that the United States and NATO would make no effort to draw Ukraine into the European zone and into the NATO alliance?
No, that's actually was never stated. The issue of NATO alliance was discussed with Ukraine, but really it never got traction. For a number of reasons. One of those reasons was that at that point in time, neither Ukraine as a society nor the Ukrainian leaders actually were prepared to seriously consider that. So that was never asked by Ukraine, at least formally. Again, some discussion was on the margins of the conferences, but it was never asked. So that was the issue that for the first time emerged on the international agenda already in the year 2008 during the presidency of George W. Bush. So, but in 94, the Ukraine and NATO were separate items.
Mm-hmm.
They were not. There was no discussion. There were no serious discussion of Ukraine's membership.
And Professor, I'd like your reaction to this. I've read quite a bit about the 2014 revolution, the Maidan, or it's also called the Revolution of Dignity. And in many respects, I regard it as a U.S.-backed coup of the Yanukovych government. Now, he was a kleptocrat and clearly corrupt like many of his predecessors. I make no excuses for Yanukovych. But he had been reelected, and it does appear that the CIA and USAID did play a role in the toppling of that government. And yet in the U.S. media accounts, we never refer to that as a coup. It's described as a popular revolution.
I certainly took seriously that kind of suggestions. The only evidence to support them that I found so far was the fact that Victoria Nuland, then of the State Department, was handing the cookies to the people on Maidan. So I don't buy the plot, CIA-backed or European-backed plots at all. So what happened there was that the Yanukovych government, for 1 year before the protest started, was really promising and raising expectations when it comes to the Ukrainian society that Ukraine would sign association agreement with the European Union. So it was 1 year-long propaganda. And then under pressure from Russia, Mr. Yanukovych goes to a European Union summit in Vilnius and says that he was not going to sign the agreement. And that's what brought people on the streets. And then in Ukrainian fashion or manner, like it was before that in the year 2004, they just refused to leave the streets. So it was going one day after another. The protests were not huge. But then the police was used, and they were beating up students. And that's what brought really masses to the streets. So some of these manifestations or demonstrations, the number of people on the streets were 800, even more. So I certainly treat very, very seriously CIA and other intelligence services, but I don't think they're capable of doing things like that, being so many people on the streets in the sub-zero temperatures, and those people actually then would refuse to leave.
To your comment about Victoria Nuland, I do know that she gave cookies and donuts to some of the protesters, but she also bragged about $5 billion in U.S. spending to change the regime in Ukraine.
I will have to look at that. I'm not sure what particular source you refer to. But my understanding, again, is that if she was saying something like that, the reference was maybe to what is called support of democracy or some other basically non-governmental organization support. So something that the U.S. was doing starting in 1991 in the post-Soviet space in general. So, again, I would have to go back and see that. I can't comment on that. But what I can comment on is that it's basically the suggestion of that kind betrays our belief that we think that the U.S. is so powerful, or that CIA is so powerful that they can do whatever they want, including keeping people on the streets for so long as it happened in Ukraine. The key reason was the internal battles and struggles in Ukraine versus the issue of corruption, the issue that is still unresolved.
Mm-hmm.
And on the top of that, you have, of course, geopolitical interests of different countries. And the pressure is coming certainly from both sides. But to point to the difference in that pressure is that Russia is actually trying its best to get Ukraine involved in its economic union, security union, and so on and so forth, and basically Ukraine resists to do that. On the other hand, there is European Union and NATO, and you can't get into them. So at least on that level, the commitment of the two centers of power in that part of the world to Ukraine are very different.
And just one more geopolitical question. Do you see or would you share this view that while I don't condone Russia's takeover of Crimea, that it felt that because of the way Ukraine was moving into the NATO and European orbit and after the conflict in Georgia, that the Kremlin just said, we've got to draw a line somewhere, and this warm water Navy base in Sevastopol is essential to our military. And again, I'm not condoning the violation of international law, but I am pragmatically looking at the perspective of Russia.
Navy base in Sevastopol was under Russian control, according to the agreements that were signed, until the year 2042. So they still had I don't know, I'm not a mathematician, 20 or 30 years to go there. So Sevastopol, again, maybe it was used as an excuse, but it wasn't a real reason.
I see.
But the prospect of Ukraine or Georgia joining NATO was actually very much on Russia's mind. And from that point of view, the actions of Russian army in Georgia and then in Ukraine, they create a situation where those individual countries don't control entirely their territory that is, according to their constitutions, is there. They're technically in the state of conflict, and that potentially, or in real life, really can disqualify them from joining NATO. So that's basically something that can be viewed as a preemptive move on part of Russia. But again, I try to keep open mind to those things and read as much as I can. But I absolutely believe that the the core of the 24, the roots of 24 protests. They're there, first of all, in Ukraine. Then we can talk about different countries and different leaders trying to play that game differently. But it starts in Ukraine. It's about issues of Ukraine orientation in the world, its commitment to democracy, and its task to clean the country from corruption. So that those were the issues back then. They, to a different degree, continue to be big issues today.
So the outlines of the narrative of Donald Trump's effort to squeeze Volodymyr Zelensky into opening investigations into Burisma, Biden, and the 2016 chicanery that Trump believes occurred in Ukraine. How do you view this, of a guy like Trump putting the squeeze on a novice who, you know, was only elected in April, and a guy who is, I think, trying to clean up corruption in Ukraine, and is presented with a corrupt offer or a corrupt demand from the President of the United States?
Well, the general idea is that under the banner of helping Ukraine to fight corruption, more corruption is being introduced there. And that's really, really very unfortunate, because I don't think there is any way to interpret that request to President Zelensky other than interpreting the way that really the only thing that the President of the United States is interested in is dirt on his political opponent. Because if it would be a really discussion about corruption, it wouldn't start and end on the server or Biden or anything of that kind. There is a big issue of the oligarchic influences in Ukraine, including on President Zelensky himself. That's what the issues that are being discussed, including by American diplomats. Some of them we saw recently on TV. So that's what is at the core of the corruption discussion that is happening around Ukraine. It's not Burisma. And so again, I personally, after reading transcript, as certainly the president advises us to do, I had no doubt what was going on. There was the name of that was actually bringing more corruption to Ukraine, not making less.
And Professor, are you comfortable knowing that one of the, you know, cleanest, least corrupt leaders in America, Rudy Giuliani, was tasked by the president to lead his kind of second channel or irregular channel, as Ambassador Taylor referred to it?
Well, actually, I was surprised, and partially because probably I wasn't. Following enough Mr. Giuliani's career, but for me he was a big hero, of course, of 9/11 events. And then finding him in that role, I was surprised. But after doing a little bit more research, I'm less surprised today.
Well, I'll just stipulate he's never been a hero to me, and I think that, you know, he doesn't have any status as a special envoy or any representative of the United States government. He was just there freelancing. And again, as we lecture Ukraine on corruption and then try to seduce them or compel them into corrupt bargains, it's very hard to take at face value the claim of the president and Republicans that, you know, he's just dedicated to clearing up this daggone corruption.
Well, yes, that's judging by that conversation, that's not what is at the top of his agenda. Policy toward Ukraine was conducted outside of regular channels for too long. It was certainly Giuliani. There is another figure which is kind of a little bit tragic in that whole story, called Walker, who, as far as I can say, had good intentions but had play the game that was already there. But one way or another, whatever the intentions of those individuals, those were two key figures, and then there was third figure. They called themselves Three Amigos, the ambassador to European Union, Sondland, mm-hmm. and again, none of them, neither of them actually, had any formal reasons to be involved in Ukraine or to decide on the American policy in the situation where the regular channel, the State Department channels, the embassy, were apparently informed about some of those initiatives, but not about others. So clearly was marginalized.
Well, Professor, thank you for those comments. I want to turn now to your powerful new book, and you're an excellent writer, and you really bring us into the moment that you're covering. Your new book, Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, subtitled American Airmen Behind the Soviet Lines and the Collapse of the Grand Alliance. I learned a lot from your book, and I just want to share with you that my late father, during World War II, was in the Army Transportation Corps, and he ran trains from the Persian Gulf into Ukraine to resupply the Soviet Army. And that's what attracted me to your book, because he had shared some of those experiences with me. But you graphically bring us into the critical time around D-Day. This is in 1944. And you take us deep into Ukraine, into the old Cossack towns, as you describe them, Poltava, Mirhoroid, and Pyryatyn.
Pyryatyn, very good, yes.
So tell us why this was so significant that American flyers and American assets were briefly permitted to use three Soviet air bases to launch attacks against the Germans from, as you say, the Eastern Front.
Well, it was a truly, truly unique story and part of World War II, because we certainly know a lot, or at least heard about, the Grand Alliance. And that's the United States, Soviet Union, and Britain fighting together Nazi Germany. Well, there was one particular feature of that alliance that the U.S. and Britain were fighting side by side, but the Soviets were fighting their own war on their own front, which was Eastern Front. There was just one episode when the Americans and the Soviets were fighting together side by side against the Germans, and that happened in 44-45 in that Poltava area in Ukraine. Why that happened? Well, the you mentioned D-Day, and certainly the Allies started to preparations to the D-Day early in 1943, and the American goal, or at least the goal of the American Air Force, was to destroy as much of German Luftwaffe before D-Day as possible, to control the sky after that. And to do that, they had to bomb the factories that were producing planes and infrastructure and the oil refineries that were in Central and Eastern Europe. And they didn't have in 1943 the fighter planes to protect B-17 bombers, the flying fortresses, on the raid from London all the way to Warsaw and then back. So they just didn't have their gas tanks were not big enough. And then the idea was born that let's do shuttle bombing. Let's bomb those targets in Eastern Europe and then land in the Soviet territory, refuel, get new ammunition, and then fly back and bomb them again. And that was the idea in terms of this military strategy. There was also a big political component in that, to show to the Germans that the Soviets and the Americans can fight together, that it's not just talk or coordination of the military actions on different fronts. And last but not least, the U.S. commanders already knew that the battle for Japan will be extremely, extremely difficult. And they thought that they would need American air bases probably on the Soviet territory, and looked at Poltava as their first step in that direction, that once once it is successful there, they can raise the question about American bases in the Soviet Far East. It never happened there, partially because, as I described in the book, the Poltava experience was kind of a mixed bag.
Well, indeed, and one of the most dramatic moments was when, after a few of these shuttle raids had been completed, German reconnaissance located these huge B-17s. I once toured a B-17. They are amazing, cavernous bombers.
I wrote about them, but never got into one, okay?
Well, they were amazing aircraft, but they were big and quite visible from the air. And you describe how in one pummeling, the Germans managed to destroy 49 B-17s, an F-5, and four C-47s. And this was a huge setback. And the cause of this, at least according to your narrative, and I want to note that it's driven in part by documents that you got from the KGB archives, you indicate that it was lousy Russian, Soviet air defenses that made them so vulnerable and led to this huge setback.
Yes, the Americans call it Pearl Harbor 2, or Pearl Harbor on the Steps. That's the title of my chapter, because never since Pearl Harbor, actually, so many airplanes were lost on the airfields, not in the air. A tremendous loss, as you said, set back. And the Soviets, actually, they tried their best, but they didn't have the right equipment. They didn't have radars on their fighter planes. That meant that they couldn't do much during the night attack. And the anti-aircraft fire turned out to be extremely ineffective. So you mentioned more than 50 airplanes lost and not one German airplane even damaged. So that was really a major embarrassment.
And that was symptomatic of the whole way that the Soviets treated the Americans. They were very controlling. They required approval for any sortie that was launched from the Poltava airports that they were using. And ultimately, this led to what you describe as a breakdown of that grand bargain.
Yes. Well, the Soviets never wanted those air bases to start with. They didn't realize their strategic importance because they didn't have at that time strategic aviation themselves, so they didn't know what can be achieved with that. And then they were extremely insecure in ideological terms, in cultural terms. They were afraid, okay, once the Americans are there on the air bases, you can't get rid of them. They treated allies as allies, but they also were extremely concerned that their capitalist, democratic, that can be contagious, that the contacts between the Soviet airmen and then the civil population, almost like Soviets could be contaminated by those contacts with the Americans. And then once that huge embarrassment with the German air raid took place, that was very much the end. They were trying to push Americans out, and then eventually decided to get rid of the bases after President Roosevelt asked Stalin to allow American and British airplanes to use bases to resupply the Polish uprising in Warsaw that was going at that time. Mm-hmm. And Stalin didn't want the uprising to succeed because that would meant that the power, the control over the city and the capital of Poland would go to these democratic forces that raised the uprising, that were in close cooperation with the Polish government in exile in London. So he wanted Warsaw and he wanted Poland for his communist, for the communist Polish government that he created around that time.
And so, Professor, me, it is hard to put myself in the mindset of people in 1944, because no one would have known that the war was, you know, in its final years. It appeared because so many people had been involved, so much territory had shifted control, and the loss of life was so significant. I believe it was hard for them to see a future. Yet the Soviets were gaming for the post-war land grabs that led to the Eastern Bloc. And you, I think, suggest here that this really is the early origin of the Cold War.
Well, I certainly treat that really a break in relationship at those bases and around those bases as the first salvo in the Cold War. Because what I just described to you with regard to Warsaw, that was a turning point to the American ambassador in Moscow, Avril Harriman, who really dramatically changed his attitude toward the Soviet policy and to the Soviet regime. But what we didn't know until at least I was able to get to this KGB archives of surveillance on Americans, that for many rank-and-file Americans, for GIs, for officers on those bases, that was also a major, major experience that changed their attitude toward the Soviet regime. And I found that in memoirs of one of the GIs at those bases who, before the war and after the war, was a farmer in Ohio, who said that, well, it looks like what we witnessed in those days at those bases was really the beginning of the Cold War. So I think that his analysis, his assessment of the situation was correct. And my argument was that, and is in that book, that there was no really geostrategic reasons for the alliance to break up. But there were a tremendous, tremendous difference in political culture between the two allies, and that eventually, in the long term, led to the breakup in the alliance, and geopolitical interests changed as well, but those differences in political culture were already there.
Well, Professor, I feel you've done it again, as with Chernobyl, where you took an important narrative, incident, sequence of events, and gave us a broader analysis of the implications. Similarly here, by focusing in on this brief period where American fighters were behind the Soviet lines, you also then use that to help us understand much bigger geopolitical factors and the long arc of the Cold War.
Well, certainly that's what I was trying to achieve, and I'm really very, very happy that that's what you saw in the book. That's what you think its argument is, because indeed that was my intention. So, well, thank you very much. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for inviting me.
Professor, very much a pleasure to talk with you again today, and I want to recommend the book, which is from Oxford University Press. It's out in hardcover, Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front. We've been talking with Professor Serhii Plokhii. Thank you, Professor.
Well, thank you. Thanks again.
Part two of our in-depth interview podcast today. Returning to our program is photo editor Rich Cahan. And with others, he has produced a powerful new book called Aftershock, The Human Toll of War. And they have dug up archived images of photos taken by military photographers in many of the combat zones worldwide. And this book focuses on 1945. Rich Cahan worked for the Chicago Sun-Times as a photo editor, and he has published and worked with others to publish a number of books in recent years. Just 2 years ago, we talked with him about his powerful collection of photos of the Japanese internment during World War II. That book is called Un-American, The Incarceration of Japanese Americans During WW2, and he produced that together with Michael Williams, who is also a collaborator on the new book, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, and will credit Mark Jacob, who worked on this new project as well. Rich Cahan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Peter, very much.
Now, you worked at the Sun-Times, and I have some roots in Chicago. Tell me, after you kind of retired from the newspaper industry, what drew you to these archive collections and period pieces, very powerful ones, that you have worked on?
Well, I'm a big believer in the power of photographs, and especially the power of photographs and words. My colleague Michael Williams and I produce books that are based on photo collections, either photo collections of an individual photographer or collections of large organizations like the U.S. Army. And we believe that people really learn history oftentimes through visual images, but we know that it's important not to just produce portfolios. It's very important to use the photographs as a starting off point to write about.
Well, and, you know, the subtitle of your book suggests the framing, which
right.
is you're looking at the carnage and you're trying to convey to people the human cost of war in an effort to prevent it in the future.
Exactly. It's certainly a book about World War II, and it really focuses on the year 1945. But it's not a usual war book. It's more of an anti-war book. It's more of a look at the effect of war, and that's why we called it Aftershock, because it's not just an aftermath. The toll of war is so extensive and so brutal that we really looked at those photos.
And also, I would just note that veterans of various American wars, and I would just focus right now on World War II and compare that to Vietnam, but many of them didn't really want to talk about their experiences.
I was talking to the daughter of one of the soldier photographers who had passed away, but she was talking about her father, and she said that she's noticed that veterans oftentimes either spend their lives talking about the war or never talk about the war. And in this case, almost all of these men, and they were all were men, never talked about the war. And in effect, it's hard to talk about war when you're a civilian, but they had an advantage in that they at least left behind pictures, photographs of what they saw.
And I would think that many of these photographers would be more open to talking about their work in order to share what they experienced and document it.
Well, they talk oftentimes, and we had a chance to, I think, interview the families of two dozen of these soldier photographers. And most of the men enjoyed photography. Most of them had dark rooms. But very few of these people went into photography after the war. I think they had seen it all. They had had enough. There's a few exceptions. There's one photographer who ended up working for Life magazine, and there was this book is a book of still photographs, but these still photographers were actually paired up with movie photographers, and they worked as a team. And Russ Meyer, the famous Russ Meyer, was one of the movie photographers, so he certainly kept shooting, so to speak.
that's very interesting.
Yeah, and this was a very important part of his life. He organized reunions of the still photographers and the movie men for decades after the war.
Wow. And you found many of these images that are in this new book at the National Archives
right.
in a warehouse in College Park, Maryland?
Yeah, it's not a warehouse. There's kind of a warehouse attached to a really beautiful building. And this is the National Archives is where many, if not most, government records end up. So records from all the way back to colonial times. This is the repository for those records, and all of these records, including photographs, including like photographs from NASA, they belong to all of us. And so if you're interested in government documents, you go there, and it's certainly not easy to find things, but the people who work there make it as easy as possible.
And describe the quality of the film and the images that you found, and how you converted them into the presentation in the book. The production values are extremely high.
Well, thank you.
And
thank
these are scans of the original negatives. Is that right?
Yeah, I think most of the pictures in the book have not been seen before, because most World War II books kind of focus on the fighting during the first several years of the war. And by 1945, things were slowing down a bit. Not, you know, certainly there was still fierce fighting. But some of the pictures are familiar to people, but nobody has ever seen the pictures look like this, because the pictures that are in most books were from prints that were made with enlargers, and certainly they're beautiful. But these pictures are from, as you mentioned, the actual original negatives that were used by the photographers in the field. And those negatives are huge. They're 4 inches by 5 inches, so they're 20 square inches. And if you, we were able to hold and handle those original negatives and place them in a flatbed scanner and literally make a scan from those images. And the results are pretty extraordinary. Scanners love information, as everyone knows. You know, you put a piece of paper down in a scanner and they'll get every little tiny pinprick. And so you're seeing these photos in a way that no one's ever seen them before.
And Rich, many of these images are so powerful of refugees. I'm on page 45 right now, looking at a young girl who is in the ruins of her home. This is in Alsace-Lorraine.
Right.
And, you know, this is, to me, the real power of these photos and what they convey. You must have had a difficult time working with all these images. I'm certain there's an emotional impact on you, but also making the decisions about what to include and what doesn't fit had to be really challenging.
It was, and you know, all war obviously is it's an emotional part of life, and we got to. Literally, there were times when we looked at these negatives and said, you know, to ourselves, just, you know, no one's ever seen this before. No one's ever seen, you know, it's almost as if we were right there. And it was difficult, but we wanted to tell a story. And we feel like these photographers, even though they didn't know it at the time, left behind a really important gift for all of us and future generations to see. Because as I'm sure all of your listeners have heard, you know, we tend to repeat wars because we forget the impact of war. And we felt like this was a chance to kind of relive it and understand the totality of World War, the fierceness. There's, you know, we have war. I'm not trying to say that present wars are easy, but few people in America are affected by wars, but primarily affected by the people who fight them, and my hat is absolutely off to them and their families. But for many of us, it's just a matter of reading about it in the newspaper. And in a total war, and in a war that, you know, encompasses much of the world, civilians can be affected just like soldiers can be affected. The people who lived in Dresden, the people obviously who lived in Hiroshima or Nagasaki, you know, bombings, they were displaced. Many of them went years starving. So I just want people to know that when we talk about the possibility of escalating any conflict.
And Rich, your book focuses on 1945, mm-hmm. which we now know was the final year of World War II. But as I discussed with Professor Plokey in the first part of this podcast, you don't know at the time when a war will end. You are in the fog of war, the drudgery, the depressing death toll, and the human impact that you witness on a daily basis. But these images were taken at a time, and now I'm on page 51, looking at a Belgian, this is Antwerp, Belgium,
right,
where the Nazi rockets, the V-2 missiles, were unleashed. And this occurred in the final stages of World War II. And again, the victims of this in Antwerp had no idea that the war would be winding down in a relatively short period of time.
Right, and this was called the City of Sudden Death. Yes, I think we had no sense of the war. First off, we didn't think that it would be that Germany would surrender only a few months after we got into Germany, and there was certainly no sense that Japan was going to surrender easily. So much of 1945 is so important, and you can see this in the book because there's so many hints at the future. There's photographs of the first napalm bombs, obviously the atomic bomb, which has defined society ever since it was dropped. There's Jewish refugees dancing as they wait to go to Palestine, and you know, so much of the world was based on what happened in 1945. So I think it's an important history book, but more important than that, I think it's a tale of what war can wrought.
Well, and Rich, as I look at this same photo I just referenced here of Antwerp after a V-2 missile destroyed this neighborhood, it's too similar to Idlib. It's too similar to Raqqa. And this is the disturbing part of it, is that we haven't learned. And we have embarked on wars of choice. We have roiled the Middle East now for over 15 years. We've been in Afghanistan nearly 20 years. And there is no end in sight. And as you pointed out, the new normal is that, you know, we watch it on TV and it doesn't really impact our daily lives.
Yeah, I think there was this sense when the war ended that the world had the chance to change, kind of like the end of World War One. But World War Two, the whole idea of the United Nations and a place so that countries would get together and talk things out and stuff, fighting, was a remarkably idealistic and hopeful thought about the future. But as most of us feel, it hasn't been that effective. It certainly hasn't stopped war.
Rich, some of the most impactful photos in this book, I at least for me personally, relate to the liberation of the Dachau concentration camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful to my dad, who was a World War II vet, who took our family on a camping tour of Europe in the 1960s. And one of the stops was Dachau. And I will never forget it. It made such an impression on me to see the mechanized destruction of human life, the exploitation of the gold fillings and, you know, other body parts by the Germans of those who they slaughtered. And these pictures of people who were barely alive, you know, as they were freed by the Americans, it's indelible for me.
Yeah, Peter, I think that was you mentioned, I think that was the biggest decision we had to do, is where were we going to stop as far as showing violence and destruction? And we decided pretty much that we weren't going to not censor ourselves, but we weren't going to limit ourselves from that, because we thought that this was a chance to put it all down on paper. But the book, as you'll see, is not just a book of horrors. Ultimately, it's a book of humanity. There's pictures of weddings and you know, pictures of people on Ferris wheels, and we're as grim as many of the photographs are, there's a real hope in humanity throughout the book, and I think that's, you know, the nice thing is that's what makes us human in a lot of ways, and it gives us the most hope that we are human and smart enough to show our humanity.
Well, and let me just second your comment, because you don't sanitize these images.
No, we don't.
But you also don't exploit them for any tabloid or, you know, overly dramatic impact. And so I think you do it in a very tasteful way, dealing with disturbing images.
Yeah, the book is disturbing, but we wrote it so that 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds could read this book, because they're the ones that sometimes go off to fight. And I didn't want to hide it from them. I didn't want to hide it from anybody. And so I thought it was an important chance for adults and for older children, young adults, to really get a sense of war.
And Rich, as we wrap up here, talk about the powerful image on the cover of your book. This is a photo of Private First Class Jack Pulliam,
mm-hmm.
and he is wearing a German soldier's cap.
Right. We were attracted to the picture kind of graphically. It literally, it's a man who, it's almost, you talk about a deer in the headlights. It looks like it's approaching night, and there's lights shining on him, perhaps from a Jeep, and his eyes are wide open, and he's wearing kind of an American soldier's jacket, but a German cap, and you can just tell that he's totally confused. And there was a little bit of information about the pictures that were left by the photographers, but we got a chance in this and many other pictures to try to track down the subjects of the pictures. And Jack Palim is no longer alive. He died, I think about in the early 2000s. But we talked to his son, and his father left a 19-page memoir of what happened to him. And he was actually captured. He was an American GI who was captured on the day of his 20th birthday. And he spent several weeks in slave labor camps and eventually snuck out a bathroom and snuck into a town and then killed a German officer just before the Americans arrived. And he ran out of this dilapidated house and came to the American troops wearing this German hat that he had taken from this German. I don't even know if he was aware of it. And he had to convince the Americans that he was American. He said it was just amazing that they didn't shoot him as he was walking up to the front.
Yeah. And let's just enumerate that. How many, just a ballpark figure, how many Americans were imprisoned in the Stalags by the Nazis?
Thousands, if not tens of thousands.
Yeah.
And 1945 was a great year for them because they were liberated and all over Europe and obviously the war ended.
My uncle Frank, on his first bombing mission over Germany, was shot down and spent 3.5 years in in a prisoner of war camp, and he was liberated in 1945.
Yeah, this was such an amazing time as America troops overwhelmed Germany. German prisoners by the tens of thousands came out with their hands up in the air, and many of them wanted to surrender to these soldier photographers, who oftentimes were kind of on the front of the front line, and they didn't have any guns. They kind of carried a gun on the side, but basically they carried their camera. And so there's so many stories that they said, oh, you just keep walking down and you'll see someone who has a gun and can put you in prison. So what a surreal time. I think that's one of the things that this book really shows is,
Well, Rich, thank you for joining us today. Tell us what projects you're working on next. I can imagine you have many in your pipeline.
Well, as I mentioned, I try to use photographs to tell stories, and we're actually looking very carefully. We have a book coming out in February looking at photographs that were taken by the federal government of formerly enslaved men and women, and this was in the late 1930s, so these men and women were at least 75 years old, and many of them were in their 80s and 90s, and they were interviewed and photographed by the government, part of the WPA program, about their experiences, about their thoughts about slavery and what they went through. And what we've done is we're using the photographs of 96 portraits of these formerly enslaved men and women, and we're combining them with excerpts from their interviews. And it is eye-opening to me. I was, like everyone else, I was in high school and I learned about slavery, but to hear it from the mouths of people directly and to look at their pictures when you see a man who is a very dignified 80-year-old man talking about the fact that he was sold, he was given away as a wedding gift, it's very eye-opening.
Well, we will look forward to that. And once again, I want to recommend that people pick up a copy of Aftershock, The Human Toll of War. It is a powerful set of images, and as Rich Cahan has explained, they were all taken by military photographers, and the focus of the book is on 1945. Rich, thanks again. We'll talk again.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Rich Cahan and Professor Serhii Plohy. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.